This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Petri dish, noun. A small, shallow dish of thin glass or plastic with a loose cover used especially for cultures in bacteriology. Petri dish.
You're enjoying Over Boat 9 with a Petri dish with Wendy and Shane.
And today we're talking about carbon.
Yes, a special topic requested by our very lovely fan, Lonnie.
Hi. Oh,
He's quite into it. He wants to know a lot, and so...
Which is great. So we're going to be talking about all news related to carbon.
Yes, we're going to talk about, does an individual make an impact on the amount of carbon we emit?
That's right. Doesn't matter what we do. We're also going to be taking you back to the beginnings for Remember This Fact, which is, what is carbon?
And we're also going to answer the question, can burnt toast really cause cancer? And... It's not really looking at James Bond, but we are looking at Our Diamonds Forever.
Our Diamonds Forever. And you're listening to Joy 94.9. This is the Petri Dish. And today we're telling you all about carbon.
Yes, and Wendy's going to start us off with some science carbon news.
Maybe
a carbon copy of news.
Oh, I was just about to say, I wish I had a pun about carbon, and I was trying so hard, and there it came.
Aww. Carbon copies. I love it. Okay, what's our first news item?
All right,
Andy?
Planting their place in the future is what I call this. Researchers from the University of Queensland have created a new theory to predict how different plants are going to respond to climate change. Published in Nature Chemical Biology, which is a magazine rather than just three random words put together. Today, the researchers proposed that plants produce many different volatile compounds, and it's thought that these volatile compounds will help protect plants against adverse environmental conditions like excess light, high temperature, and air pollution. And
so, are you trying to tell me that these plants have a cloud of gas around them, protect them from the sun?
No, but there are plants such as lemons, for example. What makes the lemon yellow is considered a volatile plant substance because it's sort of unstable, and they think that by releasing them, they're going to be releasing more of them as a way to sort of cope with the stress of climate change.
Oh, cool. So it's not a cloud of gas protecting them.
No. Okay. No. Trust you to be thinking of gases. Ridiculous. Number two of today is Aussies Do It Better. Research from the University of New South Wales predict that global climate change will not affect Australia as badly as the rest of the world. The team compared the climate models that were employed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and tested, and this panel was sort of like a 2020 summit and they tested the theories, the models that this panel had produced against accurate climate observations, and they found the best performing climate models simulated smaller rises in Australia's temperature and around the rest of the world, but life is still going to be hot, and they predict generating much hotter waves, heat waves, than this summer.
So they were but summer came really... Sorry, I had to sneeze. summer came really late for Melbourne this year, though.
That's right, but the heat wave that sort of raised temperatures to about 47 in around Victoria, they're predicting it's going to be much worse.
So are we going to hit the 50 range?
Well, they say that 3 degrees was what they were putting it in the very near future, that it will be going up by 3.
That's quite high. Are we going to reach desert temperatures?
Well, right now we're just modelling and predicting, so it's all
can't tell
for sure. Definitely not. Our final science news related to climate change and carbon is fishy stress. According to new research from the Australian Institute of Marine Science, stressed reef fish mothers are making highly active babies. So their offspring, it could be trouble, all of these active babies. The researchers exposed fertilised fish eggs from the wild to different levels of cortisone. Cortisone is a stress hormone that's been shown that mothers, as a response to environmental stress, that fish mothers are producing more and more cortisol, and this passes on to the eggs. That's how eggs... fish eggs get hormones, and so the mothers are producing cortisol. It's going on to the fish, and it's actually producing active and deformed fish.
What does active fish mean? Like sexually active fish or?
No, just a little bit crazed out is what they were sort of.
So they're like taking a hit of speed and just zooming around.
Exactly. And they're also asymmetrical. They've got asymmetrical ear bones, which makes it harder for them to be able to sort of breathe in and no, not breathe in, but hear the ocean's atmosphere and find their way around the ocean.
Oh, no.
But we like to call this segment of the show, Remember This Scientific Fact, something perhaps you learned in high school or primary school and have since forgotten. So today, since our talk is on carbon, we thought we'd take you through what is carbon. And I feel like it should almost be a what is, you know, a question from Jeopardy or something. Who is this? But I already gave it away.
Do you have a definition for it? Is it actually a definition of what is carbon?
Well, born in the periodic table, atomic number 6. This element is identified by the symbol C. It's the fourth most abundant element in the universe. This element easily binds to a whole bunch of other elements, and this is why it forms thousands of compounds.
Okay, enough of the Jeopardy.
All right. What is carbon? That's right.
That's the answer.
I shouldn't have given away, but of course. That's right. So carbon, as I have said, is found in thousands of compounds, in all living compounds. So if you've heard of something called organic chemistry, that's the chemistry of wood, of plants, of trees, of oil. I just said of oil, of everything on this planet. I think I just said a whole lot of derivatives of wood, actually. But
yes, you did.
Of humans, of everything that is around us on this planet is created using carbon and just a little bit of other elements. That's what makes it different. Mm-hmm. Think about it like bread, that we're all different kinds of bread and carbon is the flour. And there might be a little bit of water, a little bit of sourdough, maybe a little bit of...
Ooh, and there's a little bit of yeast in there.
A little bit of yeast, maybe, you know, some nitrogen. But overall, everything is carbon. So all living organisms contain carbon, and coal, limestone, petroleum, for example, they're all fossilized forms of living organisms that contain abundant amounts of carbon. So plant and animal life that died millions of years ago was slowly compressed into these substances and the carbon was preserved. And that's how we get limestone and petroleum. Isn't that amazing?
That is absolutely amazing. It's quite the amazing element. Like, it's, you don't realize how much everywhere it actually is.
Exactly. And it is. So it's not just this bad thing that's causing climate change at all. We love carbon.
It's a love-hate relationship, really.
It's true. Now, carbon on itself is actually quite non-reactive. So by non-reactive, we mean it just sits there. It doesn't have electrons that want to bind to things. It's just quite happy. But once carbon does bind to something such as hydrogen, then it does become highly reactive. And when we say reactive, it means that it wants to create more energy, that it has energy to expend and it wants to bind to things. And so that's how we use it to create fuels.
For example, methane is CH4 and we burn that for fuel.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So, Jane, why don't you take us through, remember this fact of the greenhouse gas effect.
So, greenhouse gas effect. Hold on, give me one second. So, carbon dioxide, which is a carbon compound.
Mm-hmm. What does compound mean?
A compound means two elements put together. So, in this case, it's one part carbon, two parts oxygen, bound together and creating carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about this in the form of gas. And you may have heard of...
Again, Shane's talking about gas.
You may have heard of freeze machines, machine effects, smoke effects is good carbon.
Oh, dioxide. Like dry ice?
Dry ice. That's the term I'm looking for. I can't remember if I forgot that.
I have heard of dry ice. So, how does this fit into it?
Dry ice is the liquid form of, it's actually the liquid form of carbon dioxide, but because it's so, it has a very low boiling point, it vaporizes pretty quickly, and that's why you see the mist.
Wow. Excellent.
You learned something.
I did. So,
carbon dioxide gets released naturally by plants, by us when we breathe, and we have our metabolic reactions, and this carbon goes up into the atmosphere, la da 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 da, and they get trapped in the stratosphere, which is, I think, some top layer of the atmosphere. And when sunlight hits Earth and reflects back off Earth, we get the heat trapped in the cloud gases, and that's how we warm the Earth. Because without this, the Earth is actually minus 18 degrees. That is its actual temperature
I have a sneaking suspicion it's actually the troposphere.
Troposphere? Okay, sorry.
In the lowest segment of the atmosphere. The atmosphere has different levels.
I think you may be right.
It is in the troposphere. But the heat, the trapping effect is definitely what's going on. And so usually we live in, I thought, some sort of homeostasis that sort of plants produce carbon dioxide and suck it back up. And
let's factor out, like, carbon emissions, like using cars and fuel, because obviously the earth was created before we were all burning these fuels. And so naturally there's an equilibrium. So there's a good exchange of carbon dioxide and oxygen, and also ozone is also a normal part of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And ozone's a totally different topic as to why the ozone depletes. It's actually not because of carbon. There's other molecules that react with oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
Oxygen radicals creating the depletion of ozone.
All right. Anyway. Baby steps. So we breathe out carbon dioxide and then plants suck it back in, and this is all part of the equilibrium.
It's all part of the carbon cycle. It's called a carbon cycle. And I think there's other little steps as well in it, but it's all being recycled.
Mm-hmm.
But because we're using cars that burn a lot of carbon dioxide, there's not enough time for it to reach equilibrium, because we're producing more than it can recycle back
in. And at the same time, we're cutting down trees and deforestation.
And so that is what's causing this increased global warming, because, you know, we need the greenhouse effect. We need to be warm. We need the planet to be warm to survive. But we're creating too much carbon dioxide, thus the slow climate change and getting hotter and hotter and hotter over the past few decades.
Excellent. And so then, just to take it back to what is carbon. So just what we were saying, how carbon on its own can't really do that much, but CO2 is just carbon combined with oxygen, two forms of oxygen, and then all of a sudden it's floating.
It's quite a volatile substance. Like, it's not volatile, but it's quite reactive as well.
Mm. You're listening to Joy 94.9, and this is the Petri Dish. Today we're telling you all about carbon.
Yes.
And we've got a controversy. So every episode we like to talk about a controversy that's out there. And today, quite an obvious one, but one that I am curious about, is does your individual footprint make a difference?
And before I continue, I got corrected by another Shane out there. Yes, you're all right. Dry ice is a solid form of carbon dioxide.
Now, that makes perfectly good sense, because ice is solid. Thank you very much, Shane.
Yes.
Excellent. So the controversy. So does... I'm imagining these black balloons going into the air. Should I be worried about the black balloons I'm creating?
Well, the quick and short answer is yes. Every individual on this planet makes a very significant difference in carbon emissions, Wendy.
Oh, and where did you read that? On the government website.
This is from the Environmental Protection Agency, obviously. Yeah. So this is... I couldn't actually find statistics on Victoria, mm-hmm. on individual, they had households, but I could find something on about America and a little bit at Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So an average American, so we can use America as an example because they're both Western countries.
I think so.
An average American produces about 2 kilograms of garbage a day. If you want to work that out, that's 14 kilos a week. Or 726 kilograms a year.
Of garbage?
Yes, a year of garbage.
2 kilograms a day of garbage.
Yeah. An average American produces 2 kilograms a day of garbage.
Does that include what comes out of their mouth?
Are we going on this Republican rant again?
Sorry. Continue.
Why is it always during my segment? So there's a lot of garbage that is, and this is a lot of garbage that's going to be left in landfills. So if we times 726 a year, kilograms a year, mm-hmm. by the American population, that's a whole lot of garbage.
That's a lot of garbage. So how is this affecting climate change or carbon emissions?
Well, let's think about it. This they've estimated that this garbage can cover 990,000 football stadiums of 1.8 metres high, or filling up enough garbage trucks to reach the moon and back.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's quite sickening. So we're actually kind of heading towards these Wally-esque environment. That's not our movie for today, though, but... And there's a lot of rubbish, and this is a real problem because the degradation of these garbage products releases harmful gases.
Uh-huh. So now we're getting into why this causes.
So garbage itself, like, you know, throwing away banana peel. But if you throw away a banana peel, let's think about it. When it gets degraded,
mm-hmm.
it gets broken down into its various components. So that's going to be carbon dioxide, methane. Banana peel is not going to be that toxic. But let's think about plastics. You're going to get all the plastics... when they get degraded, they release harmful chemicals. There is nitrous oxide and some more carbon dioxide and methane.
To mention that when you're producing the plastic to begin with, you're also creating.
And so that is causing even more global warming, adding to the greenhouse gases that's in the troposphere.
The troposphere.
Troposphere. And also, you're also creating some gases that are also going to react with the ozone layer, thus depleting it as well.
Okay, so we've got trouble is we're making too much rubbish, so we need to reduce our rubbish consumption.
And that's in a Western, like, first world, developed country, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to Mexico, this figure is increased by 30%.
So they're making more rubbish in Mexico?
Yeah, so third world countries have more rubbish.
So what are they including in your rubbish? I just can't imagine making 2 kilos of rubbish every day.
The EPA did not specify what kind of rubbish, okay. But I assume it's a mixture of household rubbish. I think just mostly household and what we consume every day is okay. What...
And so what about just general turning off the lights and turning off your TV at the plug? Is all of this making a real impact, or is it just industry that needs...
If by turning off your, like, TVs and saving electricity, you are making impact because you're not using as much kilowatts too, which is being generated by power plants, and so therefore you are reducing your impact.
Okay, but I've heard that the power plants, this is from some electrical engineers at Monash, at Melbourne University, I felt like I should put a source to it or else it sounds like just me ranting.
Yeah.
The power grid, the amount of power that's released to Melbourne or any city, it doesn't change, it doesn't fluctuate, but it's just released at a certain rate that's based on how much power we generally use. And so by just turning off the electricity, they're still releasing the same amount of power from the grid. And even if you just reduce your electricity by a little bit, then it will just go wasted because they're releasing it from the grid. And so it would take everyone to reduce their their electricity use and energy use. that it would take everyone and on an average to therefore lower it, so they lower the amount of energy they're releasing from the power grid. And so in a lot of ways, the amount of energy we're using isn't really making a difference unless everyone does it and there's some sort of real conscious effort for them to recalibrate how much energy is released from the grid.
Wow. I don't know, though, because I've been on some websites where they're calculating carbon emissions, and that's based on, if I used 1,000 kilowatts of energy a year, this amount of carbon dioxide I would produce. So there has to be some sort of fluctuation, unless that means that calculator's invalid then.
I think it is. I think until the power grid changes, and I've got a few other...
I'll continue. Okay, let's go to it.
But I do like that you're on the side that the individual does make a difference.
I still am. Wait, hold on. I haven't finished my thing yet. So another example of an individual making an impact is a study conducted by University College in London. And this was reported in the Journal of Environment, Development and Sustainability. That the increase in the number of younger and more affluent people living alone, so people just living in, single apartments, is likely to cause a resource consumption crisis in England and Wales. So, they're actually younger people who live by themselves, because generally, people who live by themselves in the past used to be supposedly widowers and older people. And so, now that more younger people and more people who are more educated and demand more things are living alone and no longer in share houses... we're consuming more resources. So, to give an example, they consume 38% more products, 42% more packaging, 55% more electricity, and 61% more gas per capita than a 4-person household.
Which makes sense, because every individual needs their own fridge, they need their own space, they need their own kitchen, whereas if you're sharing these products, they need more electricity to light the kitchen and...
I don't know how relevant this is, but in household of four, each person produces 1,000 kilograms per day, which I think is a bit...
1,000 kilograms of what?
Of waste. Of waste. That includes, carbon dioxide emissions, not just rubbish.
Okay.
And those
living... So, packaged all the bad things that we release. Yeah.
And those living alone produce 1.6 kilograms. No, 1,600 kilograms.
So, 16 times more energy.
And 600 more grams. Oh, I can't. 600, yeah.
Shane, what's going on? Who are you? Why are you in the studio?
4-person produces 1,000 kilograms per day. And person living alone produces 1,600 kilograms. So, 1,600 kilograms of waste.
Okay, so how many more times waste?
600 kilograms more worth of waste.
Okay. So, but living alone is just using the most energy. Yeah.
And this is actually, I found this really funny. Particularly among men 35 to 44 who never married and live alone, they spend 39% more on household goods than their older counterparts who are over 60, and 13% more energy and 6% more space as well.
And I wonder if a whole lot more electricity.
Yeah, exactly. And so all this combined, and they're bringing this down to because there's a lack of sharing of resources, chores and goods, which has led to the increase of usage by this so-called, you know, people live alone. And that's because if we're all living alone, companies have to keep on manufacturing more products to suit us because we're no longer sharing them. And if it's another interest takes that the consumers to blame, a lot of articles on consumers to blame for global warming because demand is higher, therefore factories have to produce more.
Excellent.
The end.
That was a lovely rant. Shane reckons the individual makes a difference. I'm probably convinced that the need to produce more and therefore might increase. But as for our electricity use, I'm sort of convinced by the grid.
You're convinced by the grid?
I don't know if turning off the lights is making that much of a difference.
But I think everyday consumption and demand for more goods. Demand less goods.
Demand less goods.
Produce less products. You're listening to Joy 94.9 with the Petri Dish, your favourite science show on Joy 94.9. Does burnt toast cause cancer? Because I love burnt toast.
So do I.
But I've been banned from my mum from having it because she's like, you're going to get cancer, and sends me emails about it, and I don't really want them, but...
No.
Is it true?
Well, it's looking like it is a little bit, which is very disappointing. So there's these substances called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. So there's our buzzword for today.
Oh, there.
Carbons. Great. Carbons bound with hydrogen in a little circle is what that statement tells us. And they are carcinogens, which is a much more friendly word that we like. And a study in 2007 actually looked at different kinds of toasts to try and see how many of these hydrocarbons were found in the toast and whether it was possibly toxic levels. So it was quite a good study. Sorry, it was performed in 2007 and it was published in 2008. And they looked at flame toasting, coal grilling, gas oven toasting your bread, and indirect toasting, so an electric oven toaster.
Okay, yep. So is that what most people use, an electric oven toaster?
Yeah, I think so. So the flame toasting would be just like a flambe machine, and then there was also grill toasting. So I think one's actually like using a match to like the souffle.
Okay,
flame. Yeah, I don't know who's doing that to their toast, but
people stuck in the
18th. Feel sorry for that.
People stuck in the 18th century. That's true.
That's right. Before they knew about global warming, and they found that researchers predicted that different levels of this substance would be found depending on how you burnt your toast or how you toasted your bread. And they were right. So the electric oven toaster didn't contain any of these hydrocarbons, any of these carcinogens, but charcoaling or coal grilling and flame grilling had very important or very significant levels of hydrocarbon. And they predicted that it was the smoke that was produced was actually causing these carcinogens.
So is it the smoke biting to the toast or the toast reacting with the smoke to create the carcinogens? And a carcinogen, by the way, if you don't know out there, is a substance that can cause cancer.
Yeah, yes. Forgot about that one. That's right. So the more carcinogens, the higher your risk of cancer. They weren't sure because all they had done was just sort of burnt the bread in a particular way and then tested for these carcinogens or these cancer-causing molecules. And so they just predicted because the only way that the more carcinogens that were found on the toast were found on the toast that was burnt in a certain way that made smoke. So they just predicted that it was the smoke that caused these cancer-causing molecules.
Wow. So actually using a toaster doesn't create carcinogens.
Doesn't create these sorts of carcinogens. Now, there's also trouble because there's a few more cancer-causing molecules that are predicted. So, it was found in 2001 that charcoal burnt onto foods contains high levels of a substance called acrylamide. And in large studies worldwide, they've found that acrylamide increases the incidence of ovarian and womb cancer. And this is found on burnt toast and even golden brown chips.
We can't have our chips golden brown either.
This is trouble. This is looking like a lot of trouble. It's also been shown to increase incidences of breast cancer as well, which is, yeah, it's
this
a
is devastating news.
This is devastating. I love my burnt toast.
I love golden chips.
So, I mean, the jury's still out there. We're not exactly sure what carcinogens do and exactly why. We know basically they harm our DNA and they bind to our DNA, and this can cause cancer. But we don't know the direct link between eating something and precisely what it's doing to the body.
And so how it's getting absorbed as well.
Exactly. And it's very hard to study how much burnt toast someone is eating and to work out the direct links.
And, you know, this comes back to ethics. Can we really feed a bunch of people burnt toast so they get cancer to see?
Well, I'm sure we'd be up for that debate for science and our love of burnt toast. But I think the study, the recent one from 2008, is showing that if you've got smoke surrounding your... So don't grill your...
So if your toast is not working, don't turn on the flame.
Don't turn on the flame. On stove, that's right. And probably high levels of charcoal aren't good for you. So not incredibly burnt toast. But I think that probably just browning is probably okay, but maybe that's just me.
But is there any... Like, you know, we're talking about charcoal. Is there any correlation with, like, on a barbecue, if we use charcoal for a barbecue with our meats, does that cause the burning those meats?
Well, a large study... It was part of the Iowa Women's Health Study of over 40,000 women showed that those who consistently ate well-cooked beefsteak, hamburgers and bacon had a fourfold increased risk of breast cancer. But very hard to know.
That's not really telling me. That could be related to the meat.
Exactly. It could be related to the meat. Very difficult to say how much well-cooked beef they had, and it was probably just a survey. Do you eat well-cooked beef? So very hard to establish.
Well, there we go. So, burnt toast could cause you cancer. Still kind of inconclusive.
But it's looking like...
most likely.
That it might increase your risk cancer.
It's not going to completely cause cancer, but increase your risk,
definitely. That's right.
So, my mum is right. This is a shame.
This is... So, our myth for today is actually a fact. It's a science fact.
Oh, no.
You're listening to Joy 94.9.
Oh, poor Shirley Bassey.
This is the Petri Dish. And I was so excited about our next segment, which is where we look at movies, sci-fi movies, and we say whether it could really happen. Now, as we're talking about carbon, I thought we'd stick to the theme and talk about our diamonds forever.
Yes, and
we all do love James Bond.
That's right. We love Shirley Bassey. It's a great drag number.
It is. You two were showing that to its full force just a second ago. Now, we do have Kane, our producer on the show, to tell us where the diamonds are forever.
Well, before Wendy was talking about carbon's bonding to other things like hydrogen and sulfur to get more activity. But diamonds are actually carbon molecules attaching to each other into a lattice formation and holding together to make themselves more stable and stick around for longer.
Wow, so carbon... So it's different to other elements that are really reactive. So carbon actually just reacts with itself to create a stable molecule, is that what you're trying to tell us?
Yeah, well... As the carbon molecule can attach to four different points, if you get them close enough together, it can attach to four different carbon molecules, and two of those carbon molecules can attach to each other as well, and so that makes a triangle. And if you're in construction or anything, triangles are the strongest shape, so they hold together really well. Torsion forces don't push either way, and so if this happens millions and millions of times, you get a fairly large molecule that holds itself together very strong.
Wow.
Awesome. So, does it last forever?
They come in all different strengths, and the strongest diamonds are actually from Australia.
Ooh.
In New South Wales. So...
And how long do they last?
Well, diamonds don't deteriorate, as we can tell with our current knowledge of technology, but they do dissolve in iron. So, you can't put them in car engines, and they...
Damn it.
That's I was going to do that tonight. Put a diamond in a car engine and see what happens.
Yeah. I know. So, if you drop it in your petrol, it's gone. They also disappear in really hot temperatures.
How hot? What is the melting point for diamond?
About 800 degrees, which isn't like a fireplace, but 800. That's still... Wow. Pretty attainable.
So, what makes diamonds more stable? You said the most stable were in New South Wales, and then if they're all in that lattice structure, what would?
Well, not only is there carbon in there, but there's other impurities that can get into the diamonds. Okay. So sulfur, phosphorus, other things which offset the lattice slightly. And these impurities can give the diamonds a little bit of a tinge.
Oh, and is that why you might have pink diamonds?
And blue diamonds. Yeah. And, oh, wow. So, is there? Do you know how long it takes to form an actual diamond? Because this sounds all really fast. If I put carbon and carbon next together, two rocks, they're going to smash together and form this beautiful diamond.
Well, the diamonds actually take millions of years over really high pressures to form. Because, like, the liquid carbon and that has to be pushed in and compressed so that the carbon molecules are forced to attach to each other.
So, this, wow, this is actually fossil fuels form. Melting together to form this new compound and solidifying into this clear, semi-clear...
Yes, storage. So pretty storage.
Are diamonds actually just under the ground? Is it like gold that if we will actually find these beautiful diamonds, or are they purified a little?
Generally.
In the pretty form that we get them in rings?
Well, generally they're cleaned off, and the diamonds that we get in rings aren't generally in pure forms. They have phosphorus or sulfur in them. Yeah. I've lost words.
That's okay.
I love that you're looking at us, Francis.
I've lost the words.
So, but Shelley Bassey's onto something. That's what you're telling us.
Yeah, they will last forever. If you don't scratch them, you don't put them in temperatures above 800 degrees, you don't put them near iron, and you don't try and burn them in liquid oxygen.
Now, I just got to rant. I don't even know this or not. I was told by my Year 12 chemistry teacher once upon a time that eventually the sun will become a giant diamond. Is that true?
No, it's not, I don't think. The sun will progress until it turns into mostly iron, and then the outside will explode, and the inside will be compressed in, and if it's big enough, it can turn into a neutron star, which is where all of the
okay, maybe we'll particles save that in
it. So I think we're running out of time here today.
Short answer is no. I wanted a giant diamond in the sky to fall into.
Excellent. So our question that we had today was, when was the greenhouse gas theorized? 1896 was the first reported guess or prediction or that the carbon fuels that we were releasing mm-hmm. into the atmosphere were going to heat up the world. 1896.
By Swedish scientists. And it's just given us, like, greenhouse effect was discovered in 1824 by Joseph Fourier, and the first reliable experimented on by John Tyndall in 1958. And
Savant, in 1858.
And Savant Arrhenius is the 1896 paper.
1896 is when they first predicted. But, of course, many scientists have predicted many funny things in the 1800s, so who would have known that he was onto something.
Oh, pish posh, whatever.
That's right.
But he was right.
He was right. 1896, first prediction of global warming.
Dun, sunny dun, day.
Thank you for listening to the Peaky Dish. Today's show is brought to you by the letter C and the number 6. Thank you for listening, and I'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.